Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer, educator, peace activist, and veterans advocate Fred A. Wilcox. Wilcox is an associate professor of writing at Ithaca College. He is the author of many books on issues about the Vietnam War, the effects of Agent Orange, and the Plowshares Movement. His works include Scorched Earth, Legacies of Chemical Warfare in Vietnam, and Fighting the Lamb's War, an autobiography of peace activist Philip Berrigan. His most recent book, and the one we'll focus on, is his debut novel called Secrets. This beautifully written comic tragic story was published in fall of 2012 by Split Oak Press. And welcome to the show, Fred.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks. Nice to see you again. Now, I have to talk to you about this. You've written so many successful nonfiction books, and I heard that you've always wanted to write a novel. What took you so long?
That's a great question. What took me so long? I went to the writer's workshop and got my MFA at Iowa, and I graduated from there, believe it or not, in 1973. My mentor there was John Irving.
Oh,
and,
wow.
I'm responding to your question because he said, right before I left, he said, look, he said, you can be funny. He said, don't write that political junk. So now, all these years later, I sometimes think, I should have listened to him long before now. You know, I mean, I don't know if I'm funny or not, but I've just got into writing, you know, the sort of political stuff, and I've always wanted to write fiction. I do write fiction, and then I've always wanted to get published, and so this is a great opportunity.
Well, I'm glad we haven't missed your serious nonfiction voice, because it's certainly been worthwhile to hear what you have to say.
Oh, thank you very much.
So the resulting novel is called Secrets. Was this a novel that was brewing, or did you just say, I want to write a novel, but you didn't know what at certain points?
I think it just happened. You know, I just sat down and started writing. I've always been curious about people's secrets, my own secrets and other secrets. You know, what how do we know people? How do we get to know anybody? What are they really like?
Uh-huh.
And so I started thinking about secrets that we carry around, everybody carry around. And I somehow got thinking about this dog, Crockett. And Crockett is one of the characters in the book. And he just became increasingly alive. I wanted to somehow portray him. I wanted people to meet this dog that was roaming around in my head, is Crockett. You know.
Yeah, well, the main character is a guy named Richard Grady, and Crockett is his
Grady,
dog, right?
Yeah.
Well, I find it fascinating the way you have these two characters, you know, intermix with each other and actually have conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of the secret, though? I mean, you obviously can't know a person or a dog, what they're
right.
thinking.
Well, I think I wanted readers to try to guess, is Crockett really his alter ego? Is he even there? Is he a real dog? Because, as you know, yeah. He likes, Crockett likes good wine, he's a gourmet, he eats good food,
I know.
You know, he sometimes kind of talks to Richard, you know, gives him advice. So I thought, well, you know, people have dogs, and we do all kinds of dogs, we talk to them, and we play with them, and we pretend that they're human, and so I don't really know myself. If you ask me, is Crockett really a real dog, I don't know. He's a real dog in the sense that Richard Grady thinks he's a real dog.
Yeah. You know what, when I first started reading it and the dog was introduced, I was thinking that Richard was going crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, I really did. I was thinking, whoa, this guy can't communicate with people, so he's projecting onto this dog the things that he really wants people to know about him.
Yeah, well, you're right in a sense. Richard, obviously, he was in a war. I don't say which war.
Right.
And I'm not trying to stereotype, okay, suffering from PTSD. I didn't want to do that. But he's a very strange character. He's very odd. He's lonely. He's eccentric. He's angry. So that's the question. Is he projecting this dog? You know, is the dog a real dog that he takes out into the woods and they roam around the woods together? Or is it just his imagination?
Yeah.
And I really can't tell you. I think the fun of reading the book, at least if I were reading the book, would be to guess.
I think we can project what we want on it, you know,
oh,
like
absolutely.
A piece of art.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell you what it means. You're going
right.
to decide that for yourself.
Yeah.
Well, one of the settings in the book is Ireland. What's your connection with Ireland? You have beautiful, beautiful interpretations of that land, which I have also been to.
Right. Yeah. Well, I went to Ireland the first time in 1970, and then I just kept going back and back and back and back. I've been there many times. I lived there in 1975 on an island called Inisbofin,
wow.
Way out in the North Atlantic. At that time, Ireland was still in the 19th century. You could walk through the western part of Ireland. These villages were just ruins from the Great Hunger. Yeah.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Ireland was really very, very poor. But it was just so spectacularly beautiful. And I have to say, I had come out of, I was homeless many, many years in New York City. And so When I went to Ireland in 1970, I was walking on this little boreen, as they call it, a little back road. And for the first time in my life, I actually felt at peace. I felt like I wasn't afraid. And so I thought, well, if I feel this way about this place, I just have to keep coming back here.
Yeah.
And I made some friends. I've done some writers' workshops over there on the Aran Islands. And basically, I love the place. I think it's hard not to. I've never met anybody except maybe one person in my life who went to Ireland and came back. I don't like it. I'm not going back.
Well, I find it haunting. I went there I have a bunch of Irish relatives. I went there to try to capture what they had seen. And I was there in 1971, so we were there in about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But you captured the loneliness and the vastness and the beauty so well. I knew you must have spent time there.
I spent a lot of time there, and I've been in Northern Ireland, been an international observer up in the north of Ireland, and the whole history just fascinates me. Hundreds and hundreds of years of oppression, hundreds of years of poverty, and yet the people are so funny. They love to laugh, and so I identify.
And they love
with
to
them.
Have the drink.
Oh, they love to have the drink. Yeah,
yeah.
But the crack, the good crack, as they call it, is a good conversation. You go out and you have a couple of pints and get into conversation with somebody, and they say, "Oh, it was a great crack." But in spite of all their suffering and all their poverty in the north, where I've been in Belfast, they can still be funny. They can still make a joke. They can still make you laugh. And they have this thing they give out to you. They like to sort of torment you. And the more they like you, the more they'll torment you, which I find amusing. My son, when the first time he went, he didn't understand it, because here it would be quite rude to say something like, I have a friend up there, we were having lunch, and he said, "Oh, Jesus, Fred, would you please say something intelligent, just once in your life?" You know, and I knew he liked me.
So. The writing almost, so some of the writing in this book, Secrets, almost seems like it's being written in an Irish accent.
Oh,
do you know what I mean?
I
don't know how you capture that. You say we're moving about, and that sounds very Irish to me.
Right. Well, I've read a lot of Irish literature. I love Frank O'Connor. I love the Irish. I think they're the greatest short story writers.
Sean O'Casey.
I think once you start reading that literature, it's so musical. You just pick it up. It becomes part of your consciousness, a part of your the way you write. I have to be careful because I like it so much. I could be imitating or trying to imitate Irish writing.
What
or
they
the
call
speech.
The Irish brogue. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to be careful with that because I like the sound. I can be in Ireland maybe 3 weeks and start talking with a brogue. It's just addictive.
I know.
Yeah.
It is. I have a friend from Ireland. I knew in Amsterdam when I was living in Amsterdam. I'm always thinking about James, and he's called Seamus, you know.
Seamus, yeah. Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about another character in the book called Maggie Mallon, or Mallon, I don't know.
Mallon,
yeah.
Yeah.
She was kind of a ghost-like character. I mean, neither the reader or Richard Grady could put a finger on who she really was.
Yeah, well, see, what happened is Richard Grady comes home from this war, which, again, I don't mention. He meets the nurse who took care of him in a MASH unit when he was wounded in this war. And they decide they're going to leave the country. They're just going to go. They don't want to be in the United States anymore. So they go to Ireland, and they establish a family there on an island, and they have two little girls. And I described that. He was madly in love with her, and they had gone there to sort of create their little utopia, you know, away from war, away from everybody and everything that they'd ever known. But then his wife dies, and so he comes back to the United States, and at one point he meets this woman, Maggie Mallon. And he's intrigued by her because I almost said she's incapable of telling the truth, but that's not really what it's about. It's not about whether she lies or tells the truth. It's about somebody who literally lives in her imagination. For Maggie, there is no reality except what goes on inside of her head. So Richard is always trying to get inside of her head. He's always trying to walk around in there and take a look and say, well, okay, now I think I'm beginning to understand Maggie Mallon and her fictional world. So that's who she is. But to a certain extent, again, I've thought about this a lot. It's who we all are. You know, we all live to a certain degree in our imaginations. We make things up on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. We decide how we're going to look at something, how we're going to conceive of something, how we're going to experience something. Later on, if you actually look at it in retrospect, it's probably not what really happened. So Maggie's just sort of an extension of all of us, our imagination, except that she's gone to the extreme.
Yeah, she has. And you can feel Richard trying to pull her in like a kite.
He does.
And there's no way you can do that because the world is full of wind, you know? I mean,
right.
Honestly, I found it really fascinating.
He wants her He thinks he's in love with her, and he wants her to love him. He wants her to say it. And Maggie says, never, I'm never going to say that. You know, at one point in the book, which I think is kind of comical, they have sex, and he says something about sex, and she says, no, that's not what I don't do that. And then he says to her, well, what do you call it? What are we doing? You know, because for her, it's not really any form of intimacy. It's just an action. You know, she goes through the motions. She goes, and Rich is always trying to figure out, well, why? I mean, why does she go through the motions with me? What is this all about? He's trying to draw her out of her fictional world. He's trying to draw her out of this sort of mystical, imaginary place. I
would have given up. I found Maggie really kind of irritating in regard to the thought of being involved with her.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And but it shows something about Richard's character.
Exactly.
That he persists because she is, after his wife dies in Ireland, he comes back, and she's just about all he has except a dog. He's a very lonely person. You don't get any sense that he talks to his neighbors. He doesn't seem to have any friends. He doesn't talk to his colleagues where he teaches. He just hangs out with Crockett and Maggie. Yeah, he's a fairly quietly desperate guy.
Yeah,
you know?
And they both don't exist in some ways, you know? I mean, in the way they portray themselves.
Right.
They're both really kind of ghosts.
They're ghosts, and I'd say they're gone. You know, in other words, they're characters that probably aren't coming back. They're not coming home. They live in a world that's not totally familiar to most people. I suppose psychiatrists would call them, have a label for them, some kind of label. But they're just sort of lost souls, lost people, and they live in their own worlds, and then their own worlds sort of try to merge, but they don't. Because these are two people who really can't communicate very well with anybody.
And then I want listeners to know this isn't just a downer about two people who don't exist.
No, no.
It's very funny, Fred.
Yeah.
I mean, I found it really
thank
quite funny,
much.
Too.
Yeah.
It's that Irish humor that's kind of based on sadness.
That's so interesting because I think that's one of the things I love about Irish literature. You know, they can take the saddest thing in the world and make it funny. And you're reading it and you think, well, this really isn't funny, but I'm laughing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Why am I laughing? Well, because Frank O'Connor can take something that's quite terrible. His stories are sometimes quite terrible. And yet you're laughing because they have that ability, the Irish writers, to do that. And
that's how you survive. I mean, the Irish have learned how to survive, if nothing else, obviously.
Well, the old cone, if you don't laugh, you're going to go crazy. You know, so they know that.
I do have to ask you this, because I've asked a lot of male writers this. The last one I asked was J. Robert Lennon. Was it hard for you to get into the voice of a woman and portray a woman? Because, I mean, your portrayal seems pretty realistic. It doesn't seem like one of those male writers trying to portray a woman in it. Makes no sense to one of us, you know.
You know, it's funny. I grew up very macho, very tough. I thought I was tough anyway. Boys don't cry. I didn't cry. Mm-hmm. But also, I raised my children a lot. I was a single parent, shared custody with my wife. I love children. And I think sometimes I'm really more feminine than masculine, if that's possible. You know, Over the years, I stopped being macho. I said, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to act like that. That's stupid. I don't like it. And so I don't know if I can really get inside of women. You know, I have a lot of women students. I would teach at the college, so a lot of women. But I'd like to. I really want to know what it feels like to be the other gender. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's fascinating, at least to try.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking to writer Fred A. Wilcox. We're talking about his debut novel, Secrets. He's written much nonfiction, but this is his first attempt at fiction. How different was the process of writing fiction after all those years of probably having to do research and interviews and extensive, you know, looking into subjects?
The way I put it, it's like when I write the nonfiction, it's like being a horse in a harness wanting to race, but they won't let you out of the starting gate. With fiction, you can ride. You know, you just go off. You can ride you can be a horse or a bird or whatever you want to, but it's fun. I think the thing about writing fiction for me is it's just fun. And it's also fun to see where your imagination goes and sort of step back from that and say to yourself, am I really that crazy? You know, what is it about me that could ever make up something like that? But that's the fun of it. That's the joy of it. So to me, the main difference, not that the other books haven't been fun at times, but writing about Agent Orange is not fun.
No, that's
really
we
very,
talked
very
about
sad,
that in
very
our
harsh,
first interview.
So fiction for me is just enjoyment.
Mm. Well, it seems to me that it gives you more freedom, right?
It gives you so much more freedom. When I was writing Scorched Earth, for example, it's such a sad book. It's so very relentlessly sad. And there were times when I kept thinking, I want to put some levity in there. I want to tell a joke. And I couldn't. I actually couldn't. It just wouldn't have fit. And furthermore, very rarely when you're talking about chemical warfare, Agent Orange, do you find any way to tell a joke?
Yeah, and I read that book, and we talked about it in our last interview.
Yeah.
And there's no way you could have put jokes in that.
No. And so my basic philosophy of life is I think very Irish in the sense of no matter how sad it is, no matter how terrible things get. There's also, sometimes it's just funny. You know, you just step back from what's happening. Your car's broken down and, you know, all these things are going wrong. And if you could sit and moan and cry and get angry, or you could say, oh, this is actually kind of funny.
You know, that you put your hands up in the air and go, I can't believe this. And then you start laughing hysterically.
Right. You start laughing. Yeah. Yeah. And so I was over in Belfast years ago, and we were going down a town called Portadown. It was right during the marching season. I was an international observer, just an example. And we started out in this van. We got maybe a block before a tire blew out. And everybody gathered around. And I thought, well, they're going to get, we're supposed to be down there at a certain time. Everybody's going to start complaining. All they did was tell jokes.
Really?
You know, and we were going into a fairly dangerous situation. You know, we were going to a city called, they call it City of Hate, Portadown.
And then that was during the Troubles, as they called it, right?
In the early 70s? This was after this was on the edge of the Troubles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
We were going down to Portadown because the loyalists like to march through the Catholic neighborhoods down there, and so there's a lot of trouble. But it just struck me as here we're going into this, where the British Army was there. Some of these guys had been in prison that I was going with, and yet here we were with a flat tire and everybody's just laughing and telling jokes. And they have a competition. It's obvious, you know, you tell a joke and then I try to outdo you.
I think it's a great philosophy. It's a great way to try to get through some of this that we call life.
Right.
Now, since you have spent most of your time doing nonfiction and doing really complicated issues, did you find yourself doing research for this book too?
No.
Really?
No,
you didn't do any?
No, the only research was in my imagination. I would say I did read, I love R.D. Lang, the late British psychiatrist. So
right.
I did read one of his books called The Divided Self, in which he talks about schizophrenia, you know. Because I kept saying, is Maggie schizophrenic? Is there a label that a psychiatrist would apply to her?
I don't think schizophrenic would be it, though.
Yeah, and then I thought, no. Well, actually, I don't like those labels at all.
I don't either. Yeah.
But so I was kind of trying to figure her out as I was writing about her. I was trying to figure out, well, if I were a psychiatrist or a psychologist, what would I say about her? You know, what would I say about somebody who says to Richard Grady, you know, I'm going out of town. I go out of town all the time. She claims to have four children, all named after animals, rhesus and these different animals.
It was very funny, really.
And then she's going out of town all the time. She says to dance contests because she's training for an international sort of Olympics of dance. But he suspects that's not true. But she's so good at telling these stories. She's so good at saying what she, in her imagination, that he's not, sometimes he's really not sure, you know.
Yeah. But you know what about her, though? Why I didn't think she was really mentally ill is because her personality seemed consistent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there was nothing erratic or crazy, really, about her. I mean,
yeah.
It was just that she was a liar and she made up things.
and what, you know, she's so good at it, partly I think because he thinks he's in love with her and he's, you know, has a sexual relationship with her and she's rather attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And all these things, I think, serve to beguile him. He's a hardcore guy. He's a tough guy. He was in war, you know.
Yeah, and a lonely guy would project some kind of love, and that didn't feel like that to me at all.
No, yeah. It's a morbid attraction. I mean,
it was kind of an obsession with something that isn't even there.
Right. It's an obsession with something that isn't there. And he is determined to make something be there, you know, like we do. We get obsessed with things. We want things to work out, or we want to know somebody.
We think it'll fill us in some way, yeah.
Yeah, and the more it doesn't work, the harder we try.
Exactly, you know? Exactly. I want to ask you this, too. How did publishing a novel change you as a writer? Did it? Is it something that you want to pursue?
I just think it's really exciting. I'm so happy that the book got published. And the book got published as some students, young people at Ithaca College, read the book for 2 years. And they kept reading it, and they kept talking about it. So one of the reasons why I was so happy is if these young people liked the book, I thought that's a good sign. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a good sign, not necessarily. They don't necessarily like good fiction. Some of my students don't. But I just like that they spent 2 years looking it over, editing it. Not very much, but... So it's exciting, and also I've started another novel. I've got actually two novels that I'm working on.
Wow, great.
And it's kind of a competition now. I want to write, you know, and it is great, but, you know, I'm writing a book called Humpty Dumpty. It's a novel, and I want to write it in a similar fashion, and yet it can't work. It's a completely uh-huh. different story. It's very, very different. And so I'm sort of balking at myself as I write the book because I'm thinking... No, I want to be funny again. You know, mm-hmm. No, I want to have a strange dog again.
But I like that it's not just a comedy or just some light thing. I mean, you know, it has some depth. And you know, it has almost this minimalist feeling, mm-hmm. like you didn't waste any words. Did it take you a long time to edit this?
No. I started out as a poet.
That's what's showing.
Yeah, thank you. My great friend, Jack Hopper, you had him on this program. Jack and I lived in New York, and we were poets. I say we were. He still is. Uh-huh. So I wrote poetry at a very early age, and I got published. I think when I write fiction, or anything, really, sometimes with the nonfiction, I really have to resist the poetic voice. You know, I can't be so quite poetic. Uh-huh. In this book, it was fun, because I thought, I'll just let my poetic voice come up. Whatever's left of it, if it's still there, you know, because I don't really write poetry anymore. And that was, I really enjoyed hearing that I hadn't lost that voice altogether.
Yeah, it's absolutely, totally there, you know. It does feel like you edited away what some might think of as waste. You know, sometimes there's too many words in novels.
Oh, you know, that's an interesting thing you say. I have this feeling about some contemporary fiction that the writer is showing off. You know, in other words, the writer is saying, look how I can juggle words. And I want to say, no, just tell me the story.
Yeah.
I don't really need to see you juggling words. I don't need to be overwhelmed by your vocabulary.
Yeah,
I don't
know.
Need to be buried alive in verbiage. Yeah. I'd like you to sort of cut some of that out.
Yeah. The authors that try to upstage their characters.
Right.
You know, it's just irritating.
It's kind of like...
Because I'm a huge fan of fiction, and I don't have time for that.
No. It's kind of like, well, step back from yourself. Uh-huh. Because you're trying to create characters, and you're telling a story. And so you're not really on a stage. You're not talking to Johnny Carson. You're actually trying to talk to your readers.
Exactly, you know?
So I don't like that kind of fiction where the writer's, showing his or her great vocabulary or great use of words.
Has this book gotten reviewed? Are you paying attention to reviews and how do you react?
Not that I know of. Not yet, yeah. I think the Ithaca Times is going to review it. I have an agent in New York, a very big-time agent. I gave it to him months ago, but... He probably is looking at it, will this make a film? You know, that's pretty much what they do now. You know, they don't really want a book unless it's going to... They can call Hollywood, say, I've got this book, I'll read 5 pages to you, how's it sound, let's make a movie.
Yeah, and let's ruin the novel.
Yeah, let's ruin it, yeah. Yeah, and I wouldn't like that to happen. But it is... I'm hoping that he'll read it. We'll see what he says.
But has this changed you in any way as a teacher, though, in regard to how you teach writing? Do you teach creative writing as well,
I do.
Right?
I mean, yeah. I think it's given me more confidence. As you know, I've taught creative writing for years and years, but I've always thought, well, I'm teaching creative writing, but I'm always publishing nonfiction books. I'm always publishing what I call creative nonfiction. Mm-hmm. But I think now I can bring this book into class and say, see, really? I really can write fiction, not mm-hmm. just teach fiction. And I wouldn't require my students to read it necessarily in a fiction writing class, although I might, you know, just for the fun of it.
I would think they'd want to.
Yeah.
Because then they can say, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. I'm going to take a different, you know, or whatever,
well,
you know.
Yeah, I do have students read some of my work, but it's hard for them to comment because I'm their professor, you know, and they're rather reluctant. Some aren't. They'll be harsh and critics, but they're rather reluctant to say what they might really think or feel about your work if you're their authority figure.
Does presenting this piece of fiction make you feel more vulnerable, though? Because this is more from your heart than it is from facts that you've compiled and issues.
Well, it makes me feel vulnerable, but also liberated in a way. You know, because I think, again, I always wanted to write fiction, and I have sort of been writing fiction like a closet fiction writer. Uh-huh. So now I can say I'm out of the closet as a fiction writer. You know, I've been telling people, yeah, I write fiction. Well, where is it? Let me see it. Are you telling me, when do you write fiction? What kind of kind do you write? And I don't show. I've almost never shown my work to anybody, really. It's sort of my little secret that I do at home when I'm not writing nonfiction.
Wow.
So this is sort of like very liberating to me. It's mm-hmm. opening up. And it also shows me, myself, and I, you know, that, yeah, you know, I can write fiction. You know, it's not just a dream. It's not just something that I've been thinking, well, I'll put it off for another 10 years, and someday, maybe, I'll sit down and try to write it. Well, I wanted to write fiction, and I did write fiction, and so now I'll keep writing fiction.
Yeah. You have such close ties also to Vietnam and what we have done there and what has happened in the ensuing mm-hmm. years since the war ended. Do you think you'll ever write a novel placed in Vietnam?
Well, you know, I don't think so, because Vietnam is such an absolutely mysterious, bewildering place. I'm going to go there again, probably with a couple of Vietnamese guys who are making a film on a documentary on Agent Orange. Oh. So I may go over with them and spend more time there. But wandering around Vietnam as I have, it really is like going to another planet. You know, you see the people, well, they're human. And yet, I can't understand anything. I don't have a clue what's going on. People are walking and driving. I know that. They're eating lunch. I know that. Uh-huh. But beyond that, it's just such a mysterious culture. So I think I would probably have to spend maybe a year there before I could even begin to grasp things well enough to try to write a novel or a fiction.
Wow.
Yeah. Maybe not. And Graham Greene, you know, he wrote The Quiet American. He spent something like 6 weeks in Vietnam. And I've read that book many times.
Oh, it's a beautiful book. Yeah.
And I always assumed that he must have been there for years. And when I found out he was there for 6 weeks, I was just absolutely stunned and in awe of somebody who could spend so little time in such an exotic place and yet write a novel as though he really knew it. He knew the Vietnamese people.
I'm surprised to hear you say that because you've written so much about what the results of the Vietnam War were.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think it's because of your American guilt that you've kept yourself distant?
No, because I don't actually feel guilty. I feel guilty for my country.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I feel guilty for my nation. Yeah. I feel guilty for my government and for the chemical companies that, you know, poison the people. But I opposed the war, and I did what I could. I never felt like I did enough. You know, I got beat up. I got this tear gas, those things.
Yeah.
I always felt... but I did take a stand. I did resist it, and I'm very happy I did, and I'm very happy that I met a lot of other people who did, and so that gives me a certain satisfaction. But I would like to see the United States government at some point admit that it committed chemical warfare. I would like to say. And maybe when it does, then I'll write a novel. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, Fred Wilcox, we're almost out of time. Did you have contact information so that people can get in touch?
Oh, sure. My email is just fwilcox@ithaca.edu. And that's probably the best way. I don't do Facebook or anything like that.
Are you going to be giving any readings of this book in the coming months?
I don't think so. I gave a reading at the Bookery, or Buffalo Street Books, and I gave a reading at Ithaca College just about 3 weeks ago. So if somebody wants to invite me, I'd certainly come. I like to read the book. I think it's a very fun book to read. Yeah. I like the way it sounds when I read it aloud. Uh-huh. I think it has a nice sound.
Yeah. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. And again, it's called Secrets, Fred Wilcox's debut novel, and it's wonderful. Please continue writing these kinds of things.
Oh, thank you. I will. And please continue inviting me on your great program.
Thank you, Fred.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.